welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gather to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, a forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska, recorded at UAA on September 22nd. Pete Slaby, Vice President of Shell Oil Alaska, John Schoen, Audubon Alaska's Senior Science Advisor, David Ramser, Chief of Staff for Senator Mark Begich, and Harold Curran, Chief Administrative Officer for North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta, all participated in the panel discussion moderated by KSKA's Michael Carey. The International Association for Energy Economics Anchorage Chapter and UAA hosted the forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium.
Good evening. On behalf of UAA and the Anchorage Chapter of the International Association of Energy Economists, IAEE, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's forum and thank you for coming. My name is Roger Marks. I'm the president of the Anchorage IAEE this year. So, April 20th, 2010, beyond the tragedy of the 11 lives that were lost when the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded, I think there were three emotions a lot of Americans, a lot of Alaskans had as we watched this summer the footage of oil spewing forth from the ocean floor 1 mile beneath the surface. And I think the first emotion was astonishment that such an event could happen and that nobody really knew what to do about it. The second emotion was empathy for the citizens down there whose livelihoods were threatened and whose surroundings were fouled. And the third emotion was, frankly, disgust at all the mess. Now, it's difficult not to think that this has become a game changer, not only for the Gulf of Mexico drilling, but for the Alaska Arctic Outer Continental Shelf, OCS, offshore drilling program. So how do we proceed with Alaska Arctic drilling? Now, it may not be good enough to simply say there's oil spill risk, go get the oil somewhere else. And it's certainly no longer good enough to simply say go get the oil from the Gulf of Mexico. But as much as we like to think we're on a bridge to a non-hydrocarbon economy, and we should strive to get there, we are going to be in a hydrocarbon economy for the foreseeable future. And insofar as we curtail domestic supplies, we'll increase costs, increase dependence on foreign imports, where many foreign jurisdictions have lax environmental standards. In addition, there's local benefits to OCS development as well, as we'll talk about in a few minutes. Well, why would an economic organization host a forum on offshore drilling? The issue on how to proceed is perplexing, and economics, for all its shortcomings, does one thing pretty well, and that's systematically examine risk and reward. What you get, what you give up by going one direction versus what you get, what you give up by going another direction. And tonight we're going to have a deliberative discussion on the risks and rewards of Arctic offshore drilling. With that, I'm going to introduce our moderator, who's going to introduce our panel. But just one quick note, who is not on the panel. We did not invite any public official who was running for office this November out of deference to their running mate. We did invite the local MMS and Department of Interior office to be on this panel. It was their judgment that as administrators who enforce rules until the rules are put in place, it was their judgment they would not have a meaningful contribution to make tonight. So Michael Carey, our moderator, is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News. He's a former editorial writer for the Daily News and a former editor of the editorial page. He's the host of Running an Anchorage Edition on public radio and public TV. Has a proven track record of facilitating deliberative discussion between disparate parties. And Michael was happy to do this because this week has been such a slow week in Alaska politics. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Carey, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to have 2 minutes of opening remarks here, and our panelists are listed in the handout, with the exception of Mayor Itta, who is not here. He was going to be here by electronic hookup, but he's ill, and he has been replaced by Harold Curran, who is sitting in the first chair at the table. Harold is Chief Administrative Officer for the North Slope Borough. He came to Alaska in the mid-70s as a Vista volunteer. He first moved to Barrow in 81. Harold has served a number of administrations in Barrow and played a variety of roles. He is currently the Chief Administrative Officer for Mayor Edward Itta. He is deeply involved in the development of Mayor Itta's offshore oil and gas policies. David Ramser is going to be carrying Senator Begich's role here, but we are going to start first with a 4.5-minute DVD video from Senator Begich, and then we're going to hear from other members of our panel. They will have about 2 minutes each, but we'll make it up, and everybody will get about the same amount by the time we're finished. So let's see what Senator Begich has to say to us electronically.
Greetings from Washington. I wish I could join you in person, but I commend the IAEA and the UAA for putting together this important program. Both the topic and scheduling of this event are especially timely. Although Deepwater Horizon has faded from the headlines, how to safely develop America's energy resources remains a hot topic in Alaska and in Washington, D.C. The facts are pretty simple. Each year, this nation consumes about 7.5 billion barrels of petroleum and another 23 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Certainly, each of us supports the transition to alternative energy sources. But the simple fact is that Americans will continue to rely on oil and gas for a long time. Unfortunately, much of the oil and gas we use comes from countries that don't like us. For example, every day we send $100 million in oil payments to Iran, who's not exactly our best friend. Besides further empowering those countries, we're exporting millions of jobs that should be held by Alaskans and other Americans. There's no question that the big bonanza when it comes to oil and gas reserves lies beneath Alaska's coastal waters. 22 billion barrels of oil and 100 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Seas alone. I believe we can and should develop these resources in a way that protects the marine environment and wildlife and coastal residents who rely on them. I know my friend Mayor Itta would have it no other way, and I commend him for his forceful leadership. That's why my 7-bill Arctic legislation package was all about, preparing for resource development and international shipping that is coming to a changing Arctic. In addition, I recently introduced 3 other bills designed specifically to prevent oil spills and to aggressively clean up one up should there ever occur. These bills require NOAA and the Coast Guard to plan and prepare for a spill in the Arctic, provide funding for oil spill research, and require any company responsible for a spill to deposit into an escrow account funds which are adequate to compensate those affected by a spill. The other issue I'm working especially hard on is making sure that the communities affected by offshore development receive a share of the revenues to deal with the impacts of development. My OCS revenue sharing bill provides for 37.5% of the revenues of development in federal waters to go to the state of Alaska, coastal communities, Alaska Native corporations, and tribal organizations. The last provision, revenue sharing with tribes, is unique to my legislation. I feel strongly about it because Alaska Native organizations play such a key role in our state's development. In 2006, after the Katrina disaster, Congress approved revenue sharing for Gulf states. Unfortunately, Alaska was left out. Had it been included, Alaska would have received more than $900 million of the $2.6 billion in revenues from the 2008 Chukchi Sea leases alone. That could have helped communities build roads and ports and spurred investment in renewable energy and efficiency. To be frank, revenue sharing is not popular among most senators because their states don't benefit. But I've been insisting on it since I arrived in Washington, and so far it has been included in energy legislation pending in the Senate. As for the prospects of energy legislation passing Congress this year, I wish I could be more optimistic. Election year politics seem to have slowed progress on just about everything around here. I'm also very frustrated with the Obama administration, which has allowed development in Alaska to get caught up in their response to the Gulf of Mexico. Shell has invested billions of dollars in responsible development plan and should be permitted to proceed. Just a few days ago, I wrote a strongly worded letter to the president requesting certainty on Alaska development schedule for the coming season. I will continue to fight the administration and the Senate for responsible OCS development in Alaska because our national economy and our energy security depends on it. Thank you again for this opportunity. I'll leave the tough questions for the panel, including my chief of staff, David Ramser. David, make us proud. Answer those questions well. Have a productive forum. Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay, now that we've heard from Senator Begich directly, the rest of the panelists will have 2 minutes each. And we're going to start with Pete Slaby, who is the Vice President of Shell Alaska.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. I appreciate the time that you've taken out of your evenings tonight to be here. And I'd like to point out that Shell is glad to be back after leaving Alaska for a period in 1997. But Shell has been active in Alaska for 50 years. The platforms that supply gas to the Cook Inlet were installed by Shell in the early 1960s and still continue to operate. We have a long history of drilling in both the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas, as well as the Gulf of Alaska and the area in the North Aleutian Basin around Georges Bank. I want to emphasize that point because there's many complex issues that we'll talk about tonight, but there is no substitute for safe, successful drilling. Shell's already been active in the Arctic, and we've done it before, and we feel that we will do it again. And that's not luck. It does take a lot of planning and a lot of preparation to go forward. Offshore has been Shell's bread and butter for the last 50 years, and in the Gulf of Mexico, along with numerous other locations in the world. We go there because that's where the resources are. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked, well, why don't you go to the NPRA, or aren't you interested in ANWR? And we have been active in Alaska long enough to have some confidence in the credibility of the work that was done by the old MMS, U.S. Coast, or U.S. Geological Survey, with respect to where the reserves lie. We believe that both the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas could prove the next chapter in Alaska's economic story. That's going to mean more jobs, new revenue, and critical new oil to keep the Trans-Alaskan pipeline going. It also means that Alaskans must be comfortable with Shell's plans, and we're really working to address that level of comfort in all the things we've done over the last 4 years. I'll close by saying it's really not an or option. It needs to be an and option. We need to have safety, environmental quality, and the controls, as well as these resources. If we didn't believe that we could do it right and do it in the right manner, we wouldn't be here. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you, Pete Slaby. Now let's hear from John Shane, Senior Science Advisor at Audubon.
Thank you, and good evening, everyone. I think it's a general consensus that Alaska's Arctic Ocean is the least understood of any ocean in the world. As an example, in reference to the Arctic Ocean, Governor Parnell recently stated, and I quote, "Scientific research and economic exploration are set back by low-quality, decades-old data. There is no accurate baseline to measure change, to identify trends and patterns or predict potential outcomes," end quote. Also, Alaska is ground zero for climate change, and that's having significant impacts on our marine environment, particularly in the Arctic. And a recent front page article in the Daily News last week about walrus is one good example of that. I think that uncertainty of climate change and lack of scientific data increase the risk of offshore drilling. With that said, I want to be clear that personally, I support oil and gas development onshore in Alaska's Arctic. Oil and gas are a major economic driver of Alaska. I use oil and gas, so I would be hypocritical not to be supportive of oil and gas. I think the key is that we need to be strategic about where and how development occurs. There are some places onshore, for example, like Teshikpuk Lake, where values are concentrated and risks are too high for leasing. There are many other areas from Prudhoe Bay through NPRA where leasing makes sense. Given the significance of resources in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas that could be jeopardized, we must proceed with the highest level of precautionary management. Using Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Mexico as examples, we know that major accidents happen. Until the industry can demonstrate that it can effectively clean up major spills in the Arctic ice sea environment, my reasoned opinion is that risk outweigh the benefits and offshore leasing should be deferred for now.
Thank you, John. Harold Kern in the North Slope Borough.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to be here for Mayor Oakley. I always like it when panel members start talking about how long they've been in Alaska, because the people of the North Slope have been in Alaska for 10,000 years. None of us could beat that record. They have lived in that environment and know how to manage that environment, and they insist that if there is going to be industrial activity in the OCS, that it be done appropriately. They actually believe in the North Slope Borough's policy since its inception in 1972 is that oil and gas ought to be explored for on land and produced on land before anyone goes in the OCS. But we understand that the federal government will make that decision. So some places on land they say no, and they're saying yes to OCS exploration and development. So Mayor Itta is pushing hard for improvements in both the way management takes place by the federal government and in the policies that are set in place by legislative and regulatory bodies. He has established 8 points that he's pushing for, and we are trying to work with industry and with Shell as part of industry, and then MMS's successors to try to carry out those 8 points and improve the policies for exploration and development in the OCS. Thank you.
Thank you, Harold Kern. Now we're going to have some questions that I'll be asking, and we're going to rotate the opportunity for the panelists to answer. So this time, Mr. Slaby will go first, and in the next questions, we'll rotate so that other people have an opportunity to go first, and somebody else have an opportunity to hit cleanup and go last. Let's start with the risks. The first, the most dramatic, and most typical of what comes to mind among most people, it seems to me, is oil on ice or oil under ice. Question, what do you think of the ability of the industry to clean up a spill on or under ice on a cold Christmas Eve? Pete Slavin.
Thank you for the question. So, you know, on a cold Christmas Eve is a little...
I'm setting you up.
Yeah, indeed. And I don't mind the emotive. So I need to point out that, there's clearly a difference right now between exploration drilling, which we're working on, and development drilling. Exploration drilling starts about July 15th and must end by the 31st of October. So I, the cold Christmas and the dark and everything else really won't play in that scenario necessarily. So what does it mean to clear ice? In the event, and this is something that I have to add that we've had before Macondo, Shell has put together a very, very robust oil spill contingency plan that's been reviewed, litigated, and not found short to date. So what we would do in a situation like that is indeed begin to isolate and capture the oil at the point source. Our assets would be deployed within 1 hour from the time that we would have a spill. And that involves both the assets that are in the proximate area to the oil spill, near shore and onshore assets as well. These are assets that we either own or have in contract. It's not like, for example, a fire that you have to get on the phone and call and wait for the assets to be mobilized. We have recognized from the very beginning, the very inception, that there may be an issue with a low probability, high impact event. And to that possibility, Shell has literally spent hundreds of millions of dollars in assets to put the assets in place to capture the oil before it has a chance to make a journey on a cold Christmas Eve to different parts of the Arctic. A lot of those assets are on display right now. As a matter of fact, our ice-classed oil spill response vessel, one of them anyway, will spend the winter in the Aleutians in Dutch Harbor. Our oil spill response barge will spend the winter in Seward. So we would be prepared. And I think I'll leave it at that and let others have a shot at this as well. I guess the final point I would make is that you'll hear a lot of discussion about lack of data and lack of ability to pick up oil and oil spills. And I grant you there's a story longer than anybody's arms on what's been done. There has indeed and continues to be work in areas like Norway done in the far north on the island of Svalbard through the Norwegian authorities. A lot of folks participate in this study, the old MMS, the new BOEM, ConocoPhillips, Shell, and a variety of others, Statoil and others. The results of the study are clearly a different opinion than you will get from others, and just pick up from folks that say that oil can't be collected in ice and ice conditions. Clearly not a desirable place to be, but there's also some very, very important helps. And we have indeed gone to some trouble here in Shell to actually begin to share some of these industry results with various groups. And that information's available on Shell's website. So rather than just saying blanket statement, you can't pick up oil or oil in broken ice or in ice conditions, read the reports and see what you can do under actual conditions and ice conditions, rather than relying on data and non-based factual opinions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. John Shane.
I appreciate your comments on that, Pete, and I have read a summary of the SINTEF report that you've referred to in Norway and in the Barents Sea. And my understanding of that report is that, and I really applaud that work, we need more of that work. I think that it's relatively small-scale experiments, and where I'm concerned is actually having an example where we can deal with a major catastrophic spill on an operational scale. And I think that's the question that we ask: is there technology at that operational level for a major spill? And I'm unaware of that. And I think another issue in Alaska, darkness, distance from infrastructure, lack of Coast Guard presence. I mean, that's a big issue that I hope that we can get up there. The major Coast Guard base is in Kodiak right now. So those are things that concern us, and we don't want to bet on the fact that we can do it. We want to have some assurance, some high probability of assurance that we can deal with a major spill.
Thank you, John. Harold Kern.
Thanks to Shell, I've had the opportunity to read the SINTEF report, and the mayor applauds the fact that SINTEF, with appropriate funding, actually spilled oil in ice conditions in north of Norway. That's to be applauded. Some of the problems with that report is that while it speaks in glowing terms of some of the things that were tested, it hasn't released any of the data to the public, so you can check on verifying what the report says. And we're in front of maybe an academic audience that understands the importance of that. It's my understanding that the reason they won't release it is because some of the contributors to the study want to keep that information confidential for whatever reasons. But the North Slope Borough is hesitant to accept the glowing terms of that report without that backup data to verify it. Some things that the report also discusses where it's still difficult to clean up oil in some types of broken ice conditions that in situ burning, dispersants, and mechanical applications do not work well at all in slush ice conditions. And the reason they don't is that it's hard to get the oil hot enough to burn it when it's in slush ice conditions. It's hard to get mechanical equipment to operate appropriately. It tends to jam up and freeze up. And it's hard to apply dispersants effectively in those types of conditions. But we would like to say that we think more testing like SINTEF should be done, and that the information that's gathered ought to be made available to the public so it could be checked.
Thank you. David Ramser.
Well, I'm hard-pressed to match the brilliance of my boss's presentation, but I'll give it a shot. When Senator Begich first showed up in D.C. about a year and a half ago, he called a bunch of federal officials into his office and asked about what sort of research there was about the Arctic generally, oil spills, but more generally about what's going on in the Arctic. I would say just about every federal agency out there is dabbling in the Arctic these days. And to this date, nobody has been able to give us any sort of synopsis of what agency's doing what. So I think that that begs for better coordination of science about the Arctic and development in the Arctic. He introduced, we spent the first 6 months in office doing a lot of research about what's going on in the Arctic and introduced seven bills, one of which calls for better coordination of federal science into the Arctic, including oil and gas development. I think everybody in the room knows that there are a lot of changes going on in the Arctic, and in addition to oil and gas development, there's marine shipping, there's tourism, there are a lot of other developments going on up there that we need to know more about. As these guys said, my impression is that Norway is probably the leading country on doing research into Arctic oil and gas and spills. My understanding is that spilling oil in the ice in the United States is prohibited by federal law. I think the Coast Guard supports a change in that, so we can do a limited test and just see what happens when oil is spilled. Can it be cleaned up? Can it be burned? And I know the panelists are certainly more expert than me in that area.
You're listening to a forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska, recorded at UAA on September 22nd. Pete Slaby, Vice President of Shell Oil Alaska, John Schoen, Audubon Alaska's Senior Science Advisor, David Ramser, Chief of Staff for Senator Mark Begich, and Harold Curran, Chief Administrative Officer for North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta, all participated in the panel discussion moderated by KSKA's Michael Carey.
Thank you. Next question. We know a lot about the risk to the environment, to the wildlife of the North Slope and beyond, and to the communities involved. But shouldn't the risk to the companies be part of the equation when discussing what the right thing to do is? After all, the companies spend tens of millions of dollars, and probably a lot more than that, drilling, exploring, and meeting government and other objections before they make a dime. And in this case, they've also been in court. So shouldn't we have some awareness of what the companies are risking as well? And we'll start with Mr. Curran.
Well, instead of trying to itemize what their risks are, I would say that the North Slope Borough has tried to work with Shell and Conoco in their proposed drilling in the OCS. Today, the North Slope Borough signed an agreement with Shell to help fund baseline science studies in the Arctic. And I think we both agree that having a better basis of science will help identify and minimize risks. So we're working together in reference to that. And maybe the quickest answer is we agree. Industry ought to have that type of commitment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Curran. David Ramser, and for example, David, in your case, I assume the industry comes in, makes presentations to the United States Senator. That'd be something that would happen, right? Talks about what they're doing and the cost.
They do, and the big issue after the Gulf spill is, are the companies, do they have the resources to deal with an oil spill of the magnitude of the BP spill in the Gulf? I guess if there's an upside to the spill in the Gulf, it's that BP was responsible and put up, I think, a $30 billion escrow account. One of the bills that we've introduced shortly after that spill was to try to make sure that companies that hold federal leases have the resources to pay for any spill, that they can compensate people who are affected, and that they are responsible for cleaning up the spill.
Mr. Slavy.
So I would say, you know, obviously, if you're going to hold out mitigating some of my risk, I think I would jump on that, obviously, with both feet. So we have a number of risks that we work in the Arctic, and, you know, clearly we have our geological probability of success. We also have what we call a lot of non-technical risk, which is really betting the line that the government will do what they have agreed to do when the leases were released to the oil companies, and of course that comes to this. So what I would look to do would be to look at those that would pursue an action against a permit to have skin in the game as well, and post a bond maybe at 10% of the value of the litigation to prohibit or to make more difficult frivolous lawsuits. I would recommend as well that we would, you know, that any company that actually is out there be willing to spend the money to assure that you never have a situation. And I think that's very clear in Shell's case, where we have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars in the prevention aspect of where we're going. And that looks at both sides of the equation. So the assets that we have brought into play to work and to minimize any kind of an event or oil spills are something that people should look at if they're going to operate in the Arctic. And thirdly, it's an accountability model. I think the public should demand very clear lines of accountabilities from those folks that are working in the Arctic. Is the I think the largest measure of how companies view risk. When companies are very clear about who owns the accountability for delivering the work, you can bet that they've looked very closely at the risks as well.
Thank you. John Chang?
I think when we have a major disaster like the Gulf spill, it's easy to point at the company, and we also have to point at ourselves if we're using the resource. So I think in terms of the risk involved, I would like to see more federal agency involvement in basic ecosystem studies in the Arctic environment, developing a baseline database, building a monitoring plan for the Arctic so that we can actually, you know, understand how climate change is affecting it, how resource development activities may be impacting this, and dealing with oil spill cleanup and those issues. That's also probably a shared issue that the federal government could be more involved in. So that shares a bit of the risk a little bit more than putting it just entirely on the oil companies. But we need that basic research and monitoring in place before we can move vigorously ahead with confidence that all will be well.
This is a question for David Ramsner, and only David, because it applies to an elected public official, Senator Begich, who can do something about this or not. The rest of us are, if we're voters, I guess we have an opinion, but there's not much we can do. And that question is, how do we get the Senate of the United States, the Congress of the United States, to provide us, Alaskans, with additional revenue through the legislation that he's proposed? My understanding is that there's a pretty significant resistance to that. Is that true?
That's very true. Revenue sharing, OCS revenue sharing, is none too popular in the U.S. Congress, mostly because most states don't benefit from it. As my boss mentioned in his presentation, after the Katrina hurricane, Mary Landrieu and some of the other Gulf states senators persuaded Congress to do a limited OCS revenue sharing for the Gulf states. But I mean, Senator Stevens was there at the time. He was not able to get that for Alaska. Senator Begich has been pretty irritating to a lot of the Gulf's, a lot of the senators, in insisting that if there's OCS development in Alaska, that we have to have revenue sharing up here. I'm thinking along the West Coast. I would say it's unanimous among senators along the West Coast and almost unanimous among senators on the East Coast that they oppose OCS development off of their coast. Maybe Virginia is the only exception. But everybody along the West Coast opposes it except for Alaska. And so I think that politically, there is some possibility of getting revenue sharing for Alaska in part to try to keep Begich happy in the caucus.
Okay. Thank you very much, David. People have heard so much, the people in this room, and we heard some more about it tonight, about the Gulf blowout. And I'd like to ask, starting with Mr. Slaby, what makes drilling, from a technical perspective, different in Alaska waters off the North Slope, Chukchi and Beaufort, than it would be in the Gulf? And obviously we know that there's no ice and no whales in the Gulf, and it's cold and can be dark in the north, but from a drilling point of view, what makes it different?
So am I the only one you're going to ask that question to, or is it going to go
around? I'm going to ask the other ones if they want to jump in.
Okay, great.
I figured you'd have the technical knowledge.
Thanks. Thank you for that endorsement. What makes it different? First of all, I think we have drilled wells. We've drilled some 30 wells in the Beaufort Sea, and this is the big weedy industry, 5 wells in the Chukchi. So we have a measure of pressures. We've also drilled over 3,000 wells on the North Slope area. So we've got a really good understanding of what the geology is. So geologically, this all came together at a very different pace than the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico had some rapid sedimentation by the Mississippi River over a very short period of time. That sedimentation built up and created what we would call geopressures, highly pressured areas. So if you look at what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico, you're in 5,000 feet of water, that's a mile down. You've got geopressured wells that are 18,000 feet below the surface. Here in Alaska, we are blessed with a really gradual continental shelf. We're blessed with lower pressures. That means that we're working at something around 130, 150 feet. We're working in pressure regimes that are one-third the pressure that you would have in the Gulf of Mexico. We're looking at systems that are very simple, hydraulically based, not complicated. You're looking at an area where you can have divers access. You're looking at technology that's been on the shelf for 40 years. So it is a very, very different kind of environment. That doesn't mean, by the way, that there aren't risks in drilling these wells. There are risks in any well that you drill, and I think organizations realize that. It means that there's a very different risk profile to wells that we drill in the Arctic. You asked about the ocean conditions, and I think, clearly darkness is an issue, but darkness is an issue in the North Sea, where you're working at similar latitudes, where darkness is a factor, and we've been producing in the North Sea since the 1960s as well. You talk about ocean conditions. I'm really sorry to disappoint people, but the ocean conditions in the North Sea are actually in many instances more rigorous than we will see in the Beaufort and the Chukchi with respect to wind and sea state. Can't compare. Multiple year ice is the novelty there, and I don't mean to degrade it. It's an engineering problem that needs to be dealt with and is being dealt with. Currents are more robust here in Cook Inlet. By a factor of about 3. And everybody in this room has seen the platforms in the Cook Inlet operating now for 45 years without significant amounts of problems. So I think that kind of sums up where we are with it. When we look at the global exploration profile at Shell, we will drill about 100 exploration wells a year. With respect to the difficulty on these wells fall far into the easier section of those profiles, but that doesn't mean that for an instant, because of what I talked about initially, the low probability that high impact, that these wells won't have the most scrutiny of any well we would drill in a given year.
John, I know you're a man of broad experience here in Alaska and elsewhere. Do you have any thoughts on this?
It's an area largely out of my expertise, but some very simplistic thoughts are that, number one, in the Gulf, you could have access to hundreds or thousands of vessels in a matter of hours. I suspect that you know, I know that in the Chukchi or Beaufort, especially in the off season, it's a matter of tens to maybe 100 vessels. The onshore infrastructure would be far different. I think that there are some logistical complexities in Alaska's Arctic that just, you know, are much more difficult than the Gulf.
Okay, thank you. Harold or David, do you have any thoughts on this, or should we, Harold?
Well, I think it's really important to, no matter how simple this wells may be to drill in the Beaufort and the Chukchi, it's really important to try as best we can not to spill oil in the Arctic, or not to spill oil anywhere, because cleaning up oil is a difficult task. And wind does blow on the North Slope. I know, I've lived there 20 years. And when it does blow, it's difficult to deal with. When the waves are high enough in the Arctic, it's hard to clean up oil there. So there should be an extra focus to doing that, to have fail-safe systems where you have double backups to trying to stop any kind of pressure that isn't otherwise controlled appropriately in a well.
Okay, thank you very much.
The only thing I'd notice, I think this points out that federal agencies need the resources to regulate development in both types of environments. One of the frustrations we had with the Obama administration is right after the Gulf spill, they imposed a moratorium on further further development in the Gulf. And while there's not a formal moratorium on Alaska, we were caught up in it. I mean, it was just weeks after they gave the blessing for Shell to approve or to proceed, and then they said no because of the Gulf spill. You guys have to wait a full season. We had Secretary Salazar up here a couple weeks ago, and I don't think a lot of guys in Washington, D.C. can appreciate the seasonality of Alaska development, that you can only develop, that you can only do exploration a few months a year. And because Shell was delayed doing any work this year, they have to wait until next summer, as opposed to in the Gulf, you can, you know, go down the next one.
Thank you. Now let's turn to the economic benefits. Pete Slavin, we'll start with you. Obviously, the company could benefit greatly, but to some degree, the benefits are uncertain, as we touched on earlier. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? And there's so much money that's put up front in many different forms.
So, you know, I'll probably question my first comment. Obviously, the company will benefit greatly. So we've invested over $3.5 billion here. So I think I can see Scott Goldsmith up in the audience, and you don't really have to be a professor of economics to understand that there's a huge opportunity loss on the money that we've invested. So we're not seeing any return, obviously, and we're going to wait 10 or 15 years before we do that. And I think we are there because we believe that this is something worthwhile. We believe that it can be in a material impact, and obviously we believe it can be done safely. So what does it mean for the state of Alaska, and why should you care whether we do this? And we have done some work on this, and we support revenue sharing. We think it's fair and equitable. In any of the 50 countries we do E&P work on, it really is the only way that that you align people that you work with and the people who are most impacted by what goes on. So we're fully supportive on that as well. But what does it mean for the state of Alaska? Well, it's going to mean life for TAPS. So I think Alyeska and Kevin Hostler have been really upfront about saying the lights are going to go out. Production on North Slope fields declines at about 5 or 6% a year, and that's actually pretty good work. I hate to give my competition any kind of a boost, but they're doing a good job to keep that decline rate at 5 or 6%. It will stop. The oil from offshore is essential to keep the pipeline going and to keep it going beyond the point where it will begin to freeze in the line. It's already approaching as we speak this winter, very, very close to points where you could see freeze if the line were to be shut for a prolonged period of time. Alaska also will throw revenue into the state with respect to $72 billion worth of payroll over the last year, over the 50-year life of the project, about 35,000 jobs. There's swings and roundabouts, highs and lows in that. But if we see a development scenario across the Beaufort and Chukchi, it can have a huge knock-on effect. It doesn't mean that there'll be another Gulf of Mexico style development here. You're not going to see 150 operators, 3,500 structures, much smaller, larger structures, but infrastructure will have to come behind that to support it. So it's significant, and it will mean, I think, a lot more opportunities in the petroleum reserve. Right now, we can wish that there were oil in the petroleum reserves, but wishing doesn't put oil where it's not. And the MPRA is, in my view, a bit troubled right now. We just recently had a lease sale, and if people weren't paying attention, nobody showed up, exception to Conoco that actually straightened out a few of their leases around Alpine. A pipeline from the Chukchi Sea coming in across the MPRA, because we do think probably the best way to evacuate the Chukchi would be across the MPRA, will open up opportunity for all those smaller fields that right now are isolated and stranded. So that will bring oil in. All told, we think even without revenue sharing, the value proposition for the state of Alaska, along with 35,000 jobs, $72 billion in payroll, increased royalty oil because of the volumes going through Chukchi, amounts to something over $5.5 billion. We're hopeful as well, and you know, with the support of Senator Begich and others, that we will get revenue sharing, and that's the right thing to do.
Thank you, sir. Harold Pern, the benefits to your friends, neighbors, employers, people of the North Slope.
Well, there certainly would be a benefit to the North Slope Borough. The North Slope Borough's primary tax base is oil-related property. And as Mr. Slaby has explained to us, if oil is brought on shore, pipelines are put in place, it helps increase the assessed value of property on the North Slope. That's a benefit. That study also talks about a significant benefit from the wages that will be paid. And the way it's suggested that the state will access those wages is with an income tax. That would be a dramatic change from politics today. So academic studies can put together information that sometimes build a fanciful advantage that is not very realistic. Having said that, I can go into more detail about the tax structure for the North Slope Borough. If anybody is interested in that, can ask a question after the presentation.
Okay. John Shane, is the Audubon Society willing to concede there are any benefits?
Of course. There are economic benefits, there are job benefits. I'm a biologist, not an economist. I do think that it's important that some really smart economists look at the cost benefit and look at the risk over time. And if there is a spill, how do we deal with it? What impact does that have on the North Slope and the people that live on the North Slope? How much does it cost to do this right? And, you know, so those issues need to be taken into account. And beyond that, I think I'm on thin ice with my economics.
David Renzer, you've talked about what goes on in Congress, but there are going to be benefits to the state as well. Perhaps, given your experience, you can think about that a little bit.
Well, there's clearly big bucks at stake. The figure we used, had Alaska been included in revenue sharing in the 08 Chukchi leases, that was $2.6 billion. The state would have received about $900 million. So there's a lot of money. But I think beyond that and beyond what Pete mentioned about the viability of the TAPS line, is the gas line as well. The you know, the next big boom we're all praying comes through. My understanding is that this helps make the economics of the gas line work, is to produce the gas from OCS oil and gas leases.
Thank you, David. Next question, isn't there an argument to be made, and we do hear it fairly often, that it makes more sense to develop oil and gas in the United States under U.S. regulation, supervision, and American environmental regimens than to go overseas where in some places regulation is virtually unknown? John Shane, your response to that argument.
I think that there's merit to that argument, certainly. We have very high regulatory standards. Sometimes those standards or the regulators fall down on the job. I think that's what happened in the Gulf. But I think you also have to make sure that if you're going to develop an area, you do it to the very highest standards, and you look again at the cost benefits, and you look at the people living on the North Slope, and what would a major accident mean to those people or to the resources up there. So we have to weave that into our understanding, but we have higher standards environmentally than other countries, so I wouldn't argue with that at all.
Dave Ramsey, your thoughts, comments on what you just heard from John Shane?
Well, I certainly agree with that, and I would just underscore what my boss said in the video, which is that I think something like two-thirds of the oil that this country consumes comes from foreign countries. A lot of these governments are not particularly friendly to the United States, and we send a lot of money to countries for the oil that they send to us. You know, some people could make an argument that that's why we were in Iraq, was because of oil. So I think it makes a lot of sense to do more domestic development of energy resources if we can.
Okay. Pete Slaby, from looking at your brief bio, you appear to have quite a bit of international experience. Your thoughts?
So I think you should judge any company by what they do in the light of day and what they do at, you know, dark on Christmas Eve. So I'd like to think that we, you know, would maintain the same standards, and I don't like to think, I know that we do, wherever we work, because the world is a really small place, and you can get away with absolutely nothing, nor would you want to. And so I think the standards is an important issue. And something like oil spill, and we've talked about various roles, none of the standards really preclude, nor should they, take away from the accountability of the companies to do the right thing. So we talked a little bit about the Coast Guard and the Coast Guard, you know, perhaps not being a presence in the Arctic. Well, since 1990, Open 90, the role of the Coast Guard is that of the Unified Command Center, and they are not charged, nor will they pick up a barrel of oil, nor do they pick up a barrel of oil. Having the Coast Guard in place actually is an important role, but not necessarily a definitive role in what we're doing in the Arctic. We work many areas without the Coast Guard, and so I believe that you should indeed expect the best from the companies that are working up there, judge them by what they do, and not necessarily the regulations.
Harold Kern, this would take you far from home, but any thoughts in response to what you've heard from your colleagues on the panel?
Well, the premise is that the United States has higher standards than elsewhere in the world. And I would say that every place is unique. The people of the North Slope live off of the resources in the Arctic Ocean. They are in the Arctic Ocean to gather those resources. Those resources are impacted not just by oil spills, but also by noise. And every activity in the Arctic Ocean produces noise. I would say that the difficult thing about shale is when they originally came for their 2007 permit to drill in the North Slope, they didn't adequately consider noise. They are doing a much better job today. The regulators didn't adequately consider noise. They're doing a much better job today. So I don't think the premise about it's all the same worldwide is an appropriate premise. It is unique on the North Slope. It's unique in the Arctic, and you have to accommodate your regulation to deal with that.
You're listening to a forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska, recorded at UAA on September 22nd. Pete Slaby, Vice President of Shell Oil Alaska, John Schoen, Audubon Alaska's Senior Science Advisor, David Ramser, Chief of Staff for Senator Mark Begich, and Harold Curran, Chief Administrative Officer for North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta, all participated in the panel discussion moderated by KSKA's Michael Carey.
Thank you. The third area I would like to discuss in the time we have remaining is risk mitigation, and there are many forms it can take. Pete Slaby, you commented on some of this earlier, but it probably bears repeating. Things have to be said more than once, and maybe there's some things you'd like to add. After all, books have been written on the subject of risk mitigation, and the last thing your company wants is some kind of oil on ice disaster. How do you mitigate risk in the Beaufort and Chukchi? What are the keys to your company's approach?
We, you know, when we look at risk, we look at what we call a bow tie model. So what we spend most of the time on is on prevention. And you look at recovery, and that's what we've been talking about. So recovery is about oil spill on ice or oil spill anywhere, actually, in a well-controlled event. So what we do is have a tiered system where every well is what we call drilled on paper, and we go from top to bottom on the well, looking at what the risks are and where the hazards are. The next bit of layer we have is with our people, and we train our people with required and registered competencies. I mean, these are folks that have to be competent and have to be judged competent, recorded competent to stand on a rig. We also have a system in place where we watch operations remotely, and so there's actually folks tonight watching, you know, sitting in Houston watching a well being drilled in Nigeria, able to actually see all the parameters. We indeed will have another layer on top of that with respect to our blowout preventers, our drilling fluids, and having everything in place to keep the oil in place. And you're taught that, you know, obviously, the most important thing that you do when working with hydrocarbons is to keep them inside the pipe. And finally, we have plans, and we've talked about the robustness of Shell's plans, the contingency plans we've put together to keep ice at, or to keep oil at the source. And so what we have done is put together a plan that won't require 5,000 or 7,000 vessels as they had in the Gulf of Mexico. I don't look at 7,000 vessels of opportunity going back in front of a coastline and CNN as a successful scenario. I would look at something that a system in place that actually prevents the oil as a first order, and then, you know, in the highly unlikely that this improbable event would happen, actually is in place to contain oil. So we have indeed never looked at trying to match a Gulf of Mexico, nor would the stakeholders be too interested in seeing 1,000 vessels in the air, in their oceans. But keeping things in place, keeping things safe with respect to the way we look at the wells and conservative designs are how we've managed to maintain a pretty good track record.
Okay. Next question is from my friend David Ramser, and this may be a little bit, David, like asking you, how big is the universe? But perhaps you could give us some introduction to the federal government's role in risk mitigation.
Well, my sense is that it's woefully inadequate. One of the things that we've tried to do with the legislation that we've introduced is just bring more resources and more accountability to the Arctic particularly. If there was an incident in the Arctic currently, the closest Coast Guard station is Kodiak, and I don't know how far away that is, 800 miles or so.
800 miles.
So we probably need a Coast Guard station in Barrow or somewhere in the Arctic. I think the Coast Guard is interested in doing that. We also need more science just to understand what's going on in the Arctic. One of the bills we've introduced calls for a funding mechanism. Currently, there's an oil spill liability trust fund that's funded by a certain number of cents per barrel of oil that's produced. What we would propose is 3 cents a barrel for domestic oil and 7 cents for imported oil, which is roughly the ratio between oil that comes into this country from foreign countries versus domestic production. That would raise about $300 million a year annually, and we think that that ought to be dedicated to Arctic science, better understanding of what's going on in the Arctic generally.
Okay. Harold, any thoughts on local government?
yes, the North Slope Borough has a long history of regulating oil and gas activities within its jurisdiction. It used to have a robust coastal zone management program, and under coastal zone management, which is ultimately a federal program, OCS operators have to operate consistent with that program. When the borough had a robust system, it could influence the way OCS exploration, development, and mitigation took place. It cannot do that now. We think the state of Alaska should give the borough the authority to do that. And if the state of Alaska doesn't give the borough the authority to do that, it should be more aggressive in exercising its authority to raise the standards, to apply more mitigation, and to better enable, to put a better regulatory regime in place in the Arctic.
Harold, if I might just follow up, what has been the legislature's objection to the coastal zone management program?
Well, some legislators...
As you understand it.
Some legislators have been supportive of it. You know, legislation is not necessarily just done by legislators. They operate in a world where anything they pass can be vetoed by the governor. And they also are lobbied by interested parties. And so what has happened recently in terms of coastal zone management is some feel, either in the administration or in the legislature or in industry, that the borough's regulations would be, I think the term is, roadblocks to development, as opposed to appropriate regulation to mitigate risks.
Thank you. David, you
want
to follow up?
Can I make one point about that, at the risk of introducing a somewhat controversial issue here? One of the proposals that we've made is the creation of an Arctic Regional Citizens Advisory Commission to help address some of the regulatory problems that Harold mentioned. After the Exxon Valdez spill, there was a Prince William Sound RCAC created, and there's since been one established in Cook Inlet as well. And this would be citizens who are involved in their community who would not establish new regulations but would just be involved with industry in development that affects their communities. I know the industry is not too crazy about this idea. People in the Gulf actually have embraced it pretty warmly, and there are a lot of there's a lot of interest in a Gulf of Mexico RCAC. I'm sure that that probably gives you guys nightmares, but it's an idea that we think is worth considering, to give the people of the North Slope more say in the development that affects them.
Ma'am? So yeah, I'd like to make two points. You know, there's absolutely no issue with giving stakeholders their concern and listening to what stakeholders have done, and we've done that. So we came in 2007, and you know, the real consensus was that it was too much, too soon, too fast. And I think I'm quoting Marietta on that one. We've had 400 meetings with stakeholders and changed our plan significantly as a part of that. And those are really meaningful changes as well. So there is no issue per se on the idea of using a citizen's advice and input into designing programs. We've actually put our money where our mouth is on this one, and you know, at significant cost. So I don't think that's a problem. We do think that some of the language, and you know, I appreciate Harold indicating where we were on coastal zone management, would have been a significant issue to work through, and doesn't mean that there can't be a meeting of the minds how this would work, but clearly we agree that have to have folks in the impacted areas part of the situation. Second point I would make is that, you know, I want to emphasize that we are really only talking about exploration drilling right now, and that if there is development, there is a whole body of work that will come in after that. We have spent, and I mean we the collectively, and I think people need to be cognizant of this, $500 million gathering science in the Arctic. And many of those, that science, 5,000 studies, a lot of that money was spent with the old MMS since the mid-1970s. Other governmental agencies have spent $100 million. Industry now has spent over $100 million. We've spent over $50 million. We are developing a very, a much more thorough, let me put it this way, understanding of the Arctic that clearly will need to be developed and move further when we are proposing a development scenario, but is very adequate right now for exploration drilling and the risks that would impose.
John, I'm going to put you in a Pete's chair for a day, and you get to be the world's greatest risk mitigator. What are you going to do?
Well, I think my opening comments, I said that we really know very little about the Arctic Ocean ecosystem, And I applaud Pete for the investment he's making. I think we need a much bigger investment. We need a federal government investment. We need an RCAC. I think that makes sense. You know, if I were in Pete's seat, I don't think that I could make the investment in my own company on all of that. I think it has to be a shared investment by the federal government, by the state, and by locals. And I think that we still have inadequate data to make some of these decisions and minimize risk.
Pete, did you want to add something?
Well, so it's you know, a question that hounds us as well. And as we have found out, we continue to see all of our permits challenged in courts, the Ninth Circuit and others. And interestingly enough, and you know, with due respect, they've never found that that baseline science has been inadequate. I think, again, it's looking at what it's trying to do and what it's not trying to do. It's looking at justifying exploration wells, fully cognizant that any kind of development scenario will have to, what we call in Shell, encompass the mother of all EISs. We don't shirk that responsibility. We're out there tomorrow morning collecting data to develop those EISs. But with respect to where we are right now, the federal government has spent significant amounts of money that supported those EISs and EAs that we used. That's not been overturned in what's been, you know, a huge amount of scrutiny in front of some of the toughest courts in the land.
John, I'd like to
just a quick comment. I believe that NOAA has recently weighed in on this issue and also reiterated the lack of basic baseline data. And there's virtually an inadequate monitoring system. And a year ago, 400 PhD level scientists with heavy marine experience sent a letter to the president asking him to invest more thoroughly in science. So I think that this may be an arguable issue, but I stand by the fact that there's inadequate science in the Arctic.
Thank you. Harold, you had a thought there?
Yeah. Judge Beislein, who is an Alaska District Court judge, federal district court judge, recently rendered a decision that said that MMS's EIS looked at data gaps that applied to the Chukchi Sea in Lease Sale 193, that there were significant data gaps, and that MMS failed to appropriately analyze those data gaps, either closing them, or if it was too expensive or impossible to close them, to try to determine which ones are significant, and then to put together a strategy for other ways to deal with those science data gaps. So I agree, the Ninth Circuit hasn't rendered a decision like that, but a federal court in Alaska has.
Okay, I was thinking, we're talking about environmental studies. As an editor, I'm a person who's been trained in that and noticed typos. And one of my favorite typos was in an environmental study of offshore oil development in the North Slope. They were talking about the bowhead whale, except they spelled it wrong. They referred to the bonehead whale. I guess that's the one who got caught, right? Okay, the Wall Street banking and investment crisis has become a metaphor for all kinds of things. I think we can apply it here. After all, there were regulators and regulations, and from what I understand, just about every CEO on Wall Street had risk assessment reports on his desk every morning, his or her desk, I should say, every morning. Virtually all of these executives did not believe what happened could happen, and we see the results in our financial community in New York and other places. Pete Slaby, since the burden falls heaviest on you, fairly or not, how do you manage risk assessment?
Risk assessment, meaning the
in the offshore environment.
Well, it's done systematically, and of course, any kind of exploration well or development has to be supported by systematic risk, by you know, in a new area, by a full-blown environmental impact statement, In other areas, environmental assessment, which is slightly less rigorous. We have a process as well in company where I think we've talked about that, where we look at four phases of drilling any well. We identify the risks, we develop mitigations around the risk, and it's usually not just one stream, it's two or three streams that we look at as a way to mitigate risk. So it's really inherent upon the design. There's a long history of what we do with respect to a formalized structure around risk assessment, formalized safety cases that we look at with respect to how we work with our contractors and how we assure our contracting staff is accountable as well. So it is a formalized process. We're in the business, obviously, of managing risk. We have a huge subsurface risk. We're finding in Alaska that risk migrates to the surface as well. So we're learning, I suppose, a little more on how we migrate the surface risks. And those things would be issues like oil spill and the fallout that has, or inability of certain agencies of the federal government to discharge their duties as they've agreed to in selling the leases to industry as well. It's a little tougher working with that. I guess the final thing I'd say is that we also look at the impacts and the assessments our work will have in the communities that we work in, and that's health risk assessments. It's working on socioeconomic areas as well as other areas that are really defining the benefits for the communities we work in. When we work in communities, we look at a model that indicates that we can work there successfully for 50 years. In a 50-year time frame, 100-year time frame, there'll be ups and there'll be downs. But if you've invested in making sure that the people you're working with are fully aligned and part of the work we're doing, which is what we're aiming for, you can get over the rough spaces as well.
David Ramser, it's not just Wall Street and the Wall Street regulators, but the recent history, which many of us have read, of the Mineral Management Service is not exactly inspiring in the matter of regulation. Dave, what is the ability of regulators to enforce rules, and will Congress pay for it? I know you've touched on this a little bit, but it's really important.
Well, I think that's a big question. I think Secretary Salazar is very serious about revamping the agency formerly known as MMS. Has given it a new name and brought in some new resources. The head of that agency was up here recently for a public hearing. I guess I view our responsibility as providing federal agencies the resources to make sure the development's done right. And in terms of resources, both the dollars for good scientists as well as the regulatory scheme to make sure that industry does things the proper way. That's what the legislation is all about that we've introduced over the last year.
Okay. John, same question for you. And given your experience in particular, what is the ability of Congress to enforce rules and to pay for the enforcement?
Well, I think that Minerals Management Service really has had an abysmal record, and it's being reformed, and that's good. I think that stands as an example of where the regulators got too close to the regulated, and that's something that I hope we've learned our lesson, and we adequately reform that agency. But it's been a big risk. And one example with the Gulf spill, the contingency plan that BP had referenced dealing with walrus in the Gulf of Mexico. So apparently they had just lifted some language out of an Arctic plan and cut and paste, and the regulators didn't pay attention. So that's a real problem.
Pete, you had a follow-up?
Sure. So I have our contingency plan here, actually. There are walruses in this plan, and there's mitigation. Shell's plan in the Gulf didn't have walruses, by the way. So I'm gonna take a bit of exception to the, because it's become really popular to kick the MMS, and I'm gonna actually make two comments. So there's an issue with category exemptions, what they call CXs. And I need to point out again that this has been a very rigorous process here in Alaska. We had no significant CX in Alaska with respect to the permits we had. And with respect to track records, and talk a little bit about this, and you know, clearly I think everybody, and me included, I've been in the industry for 30 years, was horrified at what happened with the BP Macondo spill. You know, clearly we are all now painted by the same brush, but you know, if my hand is long enough, I will tell you that since 1971, there have been 34,300 wells drilled in the offshore. That's development wells and exploration. Of those 34,300 wells, 276 blowouts have occurred. Of those 273, 33 had a release of oil and gas. So narrow, narrow, narrow. Of those 33, there were 33 blowouts. There were a total of 1,600 barrels of oil spilled. I was at Interior last Friday, and it was kind of interesting. The speaker from the book, and I think a few of you folks have heard this, called The Black Swan. You know, that kind of anomaly is coming to give a discussion at the Department of Interior about these untoward events. So clearly there were some issues on coziness, although I can tell you, I've never felt cozy with anybody in the MMS, nor do I feel that there have been unduly, and I'm serious about this, issues with integrity with the MMS here in Anchorage. I think the processes have been rigorous, and I think to throw the industry under the bus because of this incident, clearly I understand the dynamics, but look at the 34,300 other wells that were drilled, and that number is actually only to 2005, so that number would have gone up, and say that there had to have been a process that worked reasonably well up until this point. Complicated wells, and clearly a lot of, you know, issues on where the expertise is going to lie, but I won't accept the fact that we've drawn this conclusion when, by all measures, statistically, it's not as portrayed.
Harold, you get the last word before we go to questions. You want to sum up your wisdom for the evening or comment on what the gentlemen have said? Take your pick.
Well, I think that I'll respond in reference to MMS. Certainly there are capable and competent people that work for that agency, both in Alaska and in the United States. But we seem to have a situation here where the GAO says that MMS has kind of sidestepped or failed to adequately consider science, and there's scientists' comments in the environmental impact process. We have Judge Beislein talking about the scientific gaps and the failure of MMS to adequately analyze their in their EIS process. And we have the appellate DC circuit in Washington, DC, indicating that some environmental balancing that was supposed to occur for nationwide lease sales did not occur. All happening on science and protection of the environment. That says a fairly strong signal to me that there needs to be some modification in Alaska at MMS to try to correct that particular problem.
Thank you. Thank you, panelists.
You've been listening to a forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. Host of Anchorage Edition on KSKA and KAKM, Michael Carey served as moderator of the panel, which included Pete Slaby, Vice President of Shell Oil Alaska, John Schoen, Audubon Alaska's Senior Science Advisor, David Ramser, Chief of Staff for Senator Mark Begich, and Harold Curran, Chief Administrative Officer for North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta, the International Association for Energy Economics Anchorage Chapter, and UAA hosted the forum on the future of offshore drilling in Alaska at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium on September 22, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.